Accession number 9424, Reel 10.
Mr. Cooper, Reel 10. You were describing Monche LaPrue.
Yes.
Could you repeat what you were saying? Because I think most of it was cut off.
Yes. Well, of course, Monche LaPrue to me felt very important in my mind, because when we were up on the La Bassée front, the old sweats I was with who had been down on Alice, they always used to talk about Monche LaPrue and about the big deep trenches at Alice, and oh, you should see the dugouts and so on. So it was really rather a revelation to get there and see it all. Now, Monche LaPrue, of course, was... Monche LaPrue was really just a large hillock and built on all of it. It's a sort of little village on its own. Of course, it had been a most important point to the British and to the Germans, because once anyone had Monche LaPrue, they could see, if the Germans had it, they could see right back to Alice almost. For observing.
What advantage was it to the British, do you think?
To see behind the German lines, you see. You could even see their transport at the far away, along the Alice St. Paul Road, they could see it. So that's why it was, I mean, there were very many killed there in attacks by the British, say, 1915, 1916, and 1917, because it was a pretty static line there, you know, for 4 years, just about 4 miles beyond Alice. That is, when I say beyond, I mean to say nearer the German lines, or near the German front.
When you arrived, would that have been a quiet sector now, in terms of...
Oh, when we arrived, there have been such sweeping forward advances since the middle of August, really. So that when we reached these old German trenches, they had actually been in active land a couple of weeks before.
Would you say that the British or the Germans had the tactical advantage at this stage of the battle at Arras front?
Well, at this stage, I don't think anyone... There were no salient points, really. Monche LaPrue was the last elevated land, really, and that was a really... Well, it was still of some use to us, because we could still see a long way, but it was during the war, that static time, that's when Monche LaPrue was important.
Having evacuated their frontline trenches, were the Germans, you think, in a weaker position?
Well, I think now, on hindsight, that their morale was beginning to crumble. I think by that time they were beginning to feel they had lost the war, and I don't feel they put up the terrific resistance that they had done years before, say when we were attacking.
Did they occupy a trench system themselves now, or had they actually left their trenches behind?
No, by the from about where we were, around about Monche, they hadn't, from then onwards until these big fortifications of the Drouet-Queant line, probably 2 miles further back, well, they weren't in a trench system. They had been forced back, you see, and the next attack that the British were to make was against this Drouet-Queant line, which was a branch of the Hindenburg line, supposed to be impregnable.
How far back was the Drouet-Queant line from where you were at?
Only from where we were around Monche and these old German trenches. It wasn't much more than, I should think, about 2 or 3 miles, 2 miles perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Were there any... special defences like barbed wire in evidence there on the front line where you were?
No, just old barbed wire. No, there wasn't. The next barbed wire was the Drouet-Queant line.
When you say old barbed wire, had it
decayed barbed wire? Yes, rusty old barbed wire. But not along these old trenches. I don't know whether it had just been taken down or flattened during these big attacks, but there were no barbed wire defences around or these old trenches when we reached them.
Right, thank you. Could we move on to rations and water supplies? Was there any difference in the arrangements?
Well, there was no difference excepting that there were no such things as ration parties going down under shell fire or hurrying the rations up before they were caught by shelling. It was all just more or less down to routine. The rations came up to a certain point behind where we were, or almost up to where we were, and the rations were just taken to the companies, or in our case, to headquarters. And we had our rations much the same as we, and just the same as we did before. Except they were rather more ample when we were in the headquarters than they had been when we were in the trenches.
Oh.
I don't think they were plundered so much on the way up.
In what way were they more ample, just in terms of quantity, or was there
just
additional things?
Just quantity. Yeah. Instead of four to a loaf, or sometimes we'll get two to a loaf, you see.
So you say, you talk of plundering as the rations.
Well, of course, I think, people couldn't prove this, but when the rations left Saint-Omer, or wherever they were prepared to come up by transport, well, they reckoned it was half a loaf to every man and one McConaughey to a man. So, well, of course, they said it was like a sort of black market. The chaps would sell these things to the French population to make money, you see, or have far more for themselves. That's what I mean by plundered, really.
Why do you think the HQ staff weren't affected, whereas the frontline troops were? Or the people in the trenches were?
Well, I can't really explain why. I can't give an answer to that.
Okay, thank you. Could we just move now on to the general sort of health of the troops in the front line and look at, say, the sanitary arrangements? Start off by looking at that. Were they any different?
The difference was that there was no danger in looking for a place, or we hadn't to keep our heads down and not get out of a trench and so on. We just walked around, found a suitable spot, like you would if you were on a picnic at home. And we did our delousing whenever we wanted to take our shirts off and so on. I remember we didn't have any baths for a long time because we weren't settled. I think we must have gone about 3 weeks without any. Until we got way back. When we were at Central Valley, when we came out, we used to have sort of shower with buckets of water and that sort of thing. Well, we didn't have any of that. We just did without. We could wash better. We could wash down if we got. But even then, we didn't. Unless we were at a place where we could get water, which was, say, a little village. But no, we didn't seem to wash then.
Did you actually go back to a particular place when you went on a rest period? Like in your previous posting?
Well, when we went out, it was more a divisional rest. We went right back about 10 or 12 miles behind the line, where they couldn't even hear a gunfire.
No, I meant somewhere like Saint-Lavalle, which you've already mentioned.
Yes.
When you were in the Arras front, did you have a little village like that you went
No,
back
because
to?
We weren't static, you see. We were sort of on the move and all the time. We didn't have any place to go back to. Well, we were on rest, really, because with being in these trenches way back behind the Germans, where we could just walk around and not fear anything, well, that was our rest, really. And even the troops, you see, that were further forward, well, they had no shelling or machine gunning. They were just gradually moving up where the British and Canadians had advanced during August.
Okay, just to return very quickly to aspects of health. Were there rats in the RS sector? Or
I never saw any, no.
And what about dead bodies? So I suppose that far behind the line there wouldn't have been too many.
No, they all cleared up, you see. They were cleared up very, very quickly and taken away and buried and through temporary cemeteries, which of course later on became permanent. No dead bodies.
And the daily routine, Was that any different for you?
Well, with our routine, you see, there wasn't any routine, really. We left quite a lot on our own.
Were there any duties that you had to do whilst you were...
No.
How did you spend your time in that case?
Well, some of them would play cards down the dugout and chatter, smoke. But I think we were a pretty lazy lot when we were on rest. We didn't seem to want to do much.
Yeah. How long was it on the Arras sector before you were actually moved into frontline operation?
Oh, not much more than a week. Not much more than a week when we actually moved there.
I see. And you remained in the observers?
Yes.
I see.
Not doing any observing, really, but nobody had thought of removing us. We're still on HQ. I think, yeah, they've sort of forgotten about us.
So what did you do when you were moved up to the front line?
Oh, well, then we were allocated as runners. And we were put in charge of us was the corporal who was in charge of the headquarter runners. You see, they were company runners. We weren't company runners. We were BHQ runners.
Could you describe what your duties were as a runner?
Well, you just had to be at BHQ within probably near the colonel and senior officers, and if they wanted a message taken, well, then they'd call out runner. They didn't know your name, and you'd just be given a message, and they'd say, take this to A company or D company, to the captain, and bring back a reply. That was the job of runners.
Were you told what the message was?
Oh, no. It was just in a sealed envelope.
And did you go on your own on these journeys?
No, we went during this attack. There was another chap and myself, all was two of us. In fact, I think there were usually two. If there was, there were short jobs of runner, where there was just one man. There were usually two, because if one was killed, you see, the other one could take over the message.
How long was the journey that you had to take, generally speaking?
Well, all kinds, but in the oh, it might be just so. Perhaps a quarter of a mile, something like that.
Staying with this just for a moment, can you recall how many runners there was that were attached to BHQ?
Yes, there were the four of us from observers, but then there were also about four of the regular BHQ runners, and the corporal. The corporal was in charge of the BHQ runners, and we came under him.
I see. Why did they want extra runners?
Well, I suppose they needed extra ones in case one or two were killed. And then there were more messages. There were messages to A, B, C, and D company, you see, and they'd want more than two men at a time to go to all the companies. They'd probably just send one to A, the captain of A, captain of D, captain of C, and so on. That's why they wanted more.
In the circumstance where the line would have been held for a long time, would the captains of those companies be linked by telephone to BHQ? Or was it normal practice to have runners?
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't really know, because when I was in the front line as an infantryman, of course, those sort of things never came to our knowledge. We didn't know, and we never mixed with the officers, and we never went to an officer's dugout, so we didn't really see what happened. I know there were field telephones. There were definitely field telephones to the artillery. And there were the wires, they were not laid on the ground. Well, some of them were laid on the ground, but half of them were dug down in a trench.
Okay, thank you. If we could return now to moving up to the front line at Arras.
Yes.
Did you know that your duty would be as a runner before you moved up?
I think not. No. We were told the HQ would assemble around about 10 o'clock at night to move up to the front. We didn't march, we just trailed together, and they had the runners and the batmen and so on and so forth. And we when we had got about halfway, shelling started, and then when we got to a crossroads, we halted. Well, one of the engineers said, "Well, don't stop here." He said, "It's starting to shell, and they'd probably go for this crossroads." Well, then the shelling became intense. We heard them coming over, and we went down a bit of a slope, and the shells were coming all over the place every second almost.
What did you do at that point?
We just plodded on.
No one took cover?
No. Well, there was no cover to take, except to lie flat. If you thought there was one coming fairly close, you'd lie flat, but that was probably too late anyway. They all used to say that the shell had killed you before you had time to take cover. Anyway, we plodded. But this, and gas shelling too, our eyes were streaming with tears from gas shelling, and the continuous, over the whole area where we were marching, there was this continuous shelling, because, you see, the Germans had evidently got wind. They probably knew that there was going to be an attack on this big system of trenches, and they knew that night was a time when troops moved up, and so the whole area was shelled badly. In fact, a great many were killed during this bombardment, never reached the lines.
Do you have any idea of how many casualties the King's Own suffered at that point?
No, I never heard that. I would only find
out. What about your own company that you were in?
Well, you see, I was with BHQ. I don't think we lost anybody. And that was, there were only about a dozen of us in BHQ altogether. And then when we got near, a guide met us. And then we got to the edge of the Etapeni Woods. And he led us closer and closer. And then there was an officer with us. And we were so close that we saw very lights coming blowing up from the German lines, well, within 25 yards of us. And the officer got rather windy. He said, "Are we near the Boche line yet, you see?" And the guide was a bit flustered. Anyway, we went on, and then then we reached the big dugout in the bank, where the colonel and senior officers were, and then we were told that we were going to be runners.
That was BHQ, was it?
Yes.
You say it was in a bank. Was a bank to what?
Well, just a bank of land went up, and the dugout was in the front. I don't know why there was a bank of it. It was just a natural bank of land. And then we had to report to Corporal Livesey, the runners, and then all was just quiet rations coming up. And then we knew that there were the British barrage was going to open at about 5 o'clock in the morning. About 2,000 guns of artillery were going to open at the same second. Well, I was in the entrance to this little dugout where the officers were, and then they shouted out, "Run!" I was just on my own, and I said, "Oh, there's a trench mortar section here. Take them up to where the front line was only 20 yards ahead of us, about where they were assembling for the attack." And then the officer of the trench mortar, when we got near, we got to a small dugout post, and our chaps were in rain, not raincoats, but
capes,
Macintosh capes, and he thought they were Germans. He said, those are Bosch. I said, "No, they're ours." Anyway, I got rid of them, and then I looked at my luminous watch. I saw it was 5 minutes to 5. I thought, "I'm going to get out of this, because once our barrage starts, the Germans are going to start a counter barrage, you see." Anyway, the 5 o'clock came, and there was, right behind us, behind the Etapeni Woods, you just heard one big gunfire, and a second later, absolute clamour, 2,000 guns firing, not just behind, but all along this fairly short front, and the noise of our own shells roaring over our heads like express trains, and all the explosions not very far ahead of us. Then, of course, the Germans, they were very fond of sending up lights, showers of spark, green lights, red lights, different codes for summoning their artillery. And directly those went up, of course, then the German shells started coming. And I was on my own. I was just throw myself flat, get up, and then be an explosion of German shell near. And at last I got back to the little dugout and shelter. And it wasn't well, I was there for quite a time, and it wasn't very long. The barrage, of course, quietened down and ceased before came out and saw our troops coming back with about a couple of hundred prisoners. And they all marched down. Then it was daylight. Guns were still firing, our guns were firing right beyond. There was this big slope over the German lines, and our artillery was still firing half a mile ahead, and there were quite a lot of tanks making their way and planes flying over. And then there was a call for runner, and a chap named Burbage and I got the message, and we started out, and it was fairly quiet at the moment. Then we were walking. It was about, I suppose, half an hour before our troops had advanced to take the first German trenches. And as we walked along, there was a whole line of Canadian troops, and they were all marching in line, and we were ahead of them. One of the Canadians said, "You're a bit ahead, aren't you?" So we backed behind them.
Where were you taking the message to?
Taking it to the captain of A Company. And when we got, I suppose, about halfway there, well, a sniper kept firing, so Burbage and I, we'd run forward a few paces and then zigzag and then back again, then get up and run. But then, as the sniper couldn't get us, they suddenly started with a small small calibre field gun, and the shells came over and burst near us. And then, so we dodged to the right. Then I came across a dead body. I thought it was my mate, you see, but it wasn't. So we just went on one at a time, zigzagging, and this gun kept firing about every minute. You see, they'd spotted us and was trying to get us, and it would whiz over our head, explode, and so on, so. And then we at last reached where our troops were in the first trench. And when we got there, they'd evidently been watching that of us dodging the shells all the way there, and they gave us a bit of a cheer as we got into the trench.
How did you feel, actually, because you'd been in mortal danger then?
Oh, we were, yes. I never thought we'd get through.
Were you scared?
Of course, yes. But I never panicked. You see, it's funny, you never think, I don't think you ever think it's going to happen to yourself in a way. You're frightened, but it's always the other chap that's going to get killed. And I mentioned just then we reached the troops and they gave a cheer, but then we had to go beyond them.
Which line were they in? Sorry to interrupt you, which line were they in?
The Drocourt Queant line. The first line of trenches, yes. Then there was in the second line, we had to go to that to find A Company, but there was no firing then. And then we got into that trench, and there was nobody in it. And I thought, well, have we got too far? Are we in a German trench? So different souvenirs I picked up, like buttons and things like that. I thought, well, they may think of, if we get taken prisoner, they may think that we've got these off dead Germans, and so I threw those away. And went up the trench a little way, then a small roadway crossed it. Well, that meant the trench ceased and the road went over it, so we had to climb up and rush across it. Directly we jumped at the machine gun fired, missed there, and on the other side where we dropped into the trench there were about 8 or 9 dead, our own men, all lying tumbled as if they'd all been caught to them by the machine gun as they tried to cross. And we went along that trench, and the first thing we saw, we got to a dugout, and there were some dead Germans lying outside that, and then we got to the second dugout and went there, and then we went one of our own troops, and they just kept in it's a captain around, and said, "Oh, he's down the dugout." We went down to him, and I thought he was a bit, he was lying on a bunk down there, I thought he was half drunk, and handed him the message, and he tore it open and read it and said, "All right." And then we went back, and I...
What made you think he was half drunk?
The way he spoke, like a drunk man does. He probably was, too. And then one of the troops, I said, "Well, what about all these dead Germans?" He said, "Oh, when we got the trench," he said, we threw Mills bombs down, and the captain orders, and as the troops came up to surrender, he said, "The captain told us to kill the buggers," and he said, "and we bayoneted the lot."
How did that, what was that person's reaction to that, do you think? How did they feel about that?
I don't know how that, but I felt that it was a very un-British thing and unnecessary thing to do.
Did you say anything at the time?
I don't think so, no. And rather an ironical thing, but among these bodies of young troops lying dead, there was a little cat lying asleep and just looked up at us among the bodies.
Were there many pets in the trenches? Do you think, well, that was just a stray cat?
That's the only one I ever saw. Yes, we never had any pets or saw any cats up at La Bassée. Well, we didn't down at Arras except that one.
What did you do with after that then?
After that, we just went back to the headquarters to just say we'd delivered the message. There wasn't any reply.
Did the headquarters know precisely where the A Company were at that time? Was it up to you to find them when you went out?
Oh, no, they apparently knew, yes. I don't think anyone questioned us about that.
So you're given fairly precise directions,
yes,
where you'd find them?
Oh, no, we had to find our own way. We didn't know quite how far they were, and we came to that first trench where we knew they'd taken that, then the next trench around, which I thought might be a German trench, but they'd already taken that. Then after that, things quietened down, and then when I got back to HQ, I went down one of the 30 steps to a dugout, and that was pretty full, slept on set. Then there was a shout for runner, and I said, "We've only just come back." Whoever, I think it was the officer, said, "I don't care if you've just come back, you're going out now. And you've got to take these officers to the front line." So we set out at, I don't know, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and the difficulty was finding ways through these big belts of barbed wire that the Germans had.
I'm sorry, I missed what time you said that was.
Probably about 1 o'clock in the morning, and we had to take these officers to the front line. And there was no firing, perhaps a bit of shelling, but the difficulty was finding openings and getting through these big belts of barbed wire, which we eventually did.
How did you manage to do that?
Well, I just walked along until, you see, there was no barbed wire entanglement that was continuous. There had to be an opening through these belts. Well, you had to wait till you found one of those. Of course, an opening to a belt of barbed wire, if you're advancing, is the very place to avoid, really.
Can you explain why?
Well, because a machine gun would be trained on it, you see. But they had these belts in case, more or less, if the enemy behind it wanted to advance, then they could get through or do scouting parties or patrols at night. But as you can imagine, if there was just a gap during an attack, the ones from the machine gun would...